You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 20th of May 2022 on Monocle 24.
The World Economic Forum in Davos kicks off in earnest this Sunday, but not before Monaco's own body market in Zurich gets people in the summer mood. The US midterm election campaign is gearing up. Expect another wild ride. And would you travel Germany's rail network for 9 euros a month? You know we can't resist a good train travel offer here at Monocle 24. I'm Chris Termack. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios at Duferstrasse 90 in Zurich. I'm Chris Termack. It is our in-house daily today, and we'll be taking you all the way from Zurich to Toronto, New York, and back with Thomas Lewis, Carlotta Ribello, and David Hadari joining us, plus a special sneak preview of everything happening here in Zurich with Monocle's Tyler Brulé. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily, and I'm Chris Termack, coming to you live from Duferstrasse 90 in Zurich. It is right here in the studio that we begin, because I am joined by Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé, and also by Carlotta Ribello, senior Monocle 24 producer and presenter. Hello to you both.
Good afternoon. Good evening.
Hello.
It is a absolutely scorching day here in Zurich, Tyler, which I think is fitting considering what we have coming up tomorrow, the body market. It kicks off a sort of very big week, essentially, for the Swiss team here, body market followed by the World Economic Forum in Davos. But tell us about the body market first. What is body?
Well, body is, of course, a term used all over Switzerland, or at least in the German-speaking part of Switzerland, to refer to a bathing club. We've got, not just one, a couple of around the corner. But it's really a part of the culture in this country, where you have these wonderful setups. They can be, you know, as new as maybe the 1970s, 1980s, some, of course, dating back to a century before the last one. And this is where sometimes they can be unisex, sometimes they're single sex, or they can, of course, be segregated inside as well. And it's, I think it's a great leveler, Chris. It's a real sort of representation of democracy working at its best when everyone is stripped down, and it's kind of all on show. And in some places, there's more on show than in others, because there's a place
that
called
the Swiss tradition.
Yes, and there's a place called Utoke just around the corner from us. You know, if you go in left, then you're in the men's section, and of course there's part of it is with trunks on, and you go a little bit further left and it's trunks off. And the same thing also happens on the women's side if you veer right. And of course we've had lots of colleagues visiting, and some people don't always sort of read not just the house rules when you go there. They don't even read the house rules that we give them before they go there. And so, of course, there's been some interesting incidents that have happened. But to celebrate it, we bring together probably over 15 different vendors. We take over the street, all within, of course, the Swiss Highway Code, and we bring a variety of just interesting makers and brands, and that is from drinks producers to people doing great swimwear and everything else you need for the season, and the whole community's there. And I've already been extending invites to various leaders, political and otherwise, who are flying into Davos, and they're saying, "Oh, I want to come by. Like, I'm looking forward to seeing you after Davos." So I'm like, "No, it's like you're on your way up to Davos. You know, you need maybe some swim trunks or something." So we could have some interesting visitors tomorrow as well.
That would be interesting, especially because Davos in itself is a bit unique this year, isn't it? It's in May because of the pandemic. They delayed the normal January one. Is that your hope? It's going to be a summer event or a spring-summer event. This is our way to get in there and see what Davos in summer is like.
It is, and I think it's a great, I don't know, is it a call to action? Is it a bit of a rocket as well to the region? Because you have to think that, you know, Davos has always been this tone setter at the start of the year, but it's always happened during the ski season. This has always been something which it's when sort of Davos is open for business. And now this is out of season. So, you know, most of Graubünden, most of the Swiss Alpine resorts, they won't open for business until late June. So here you have something which is happening the very end of May. And I think it's an interesting kickstart, because if you talk to a lot of the resorts over the last 2 years, they've had some of their record years. And that's partly because people have been going there in the summer. So maybe this is also where you start to push the Swiss out of their comfort zone a little bit. And maybe we can see a holiday season start a little bit earlier. So this could be also be a good outcome from it.
Well, Carlotta, to bring you in here and go back to the market, what are you expecting from tomorrow? Tyler offered us a wonderful introduction to every side of Bali in Zurich. What are you hoping for?
Well, now I'm in doubt if I should buy swimwear or not. It really depends when I turn right at Utoke, what treat will be in store for me. Now, I'm really looking forward for the market tomorrow. I think it's going to be nice to feel a bit of the vibe of our Monocle subscribers and a Monocle family. We've been obviously missing hanging out with the Zurich crew for a while, and obviously we'll be here on Monocle 24 throughout the morning, and that's going to be really lovely. And I think I'm all for the World Economic Forum and the Bali market being combined into one. I think it really showcases what we do best. We know how to do serious stuff, but also how to throw a nice party and a moment.
Well, just speaking of serious stuff, Tyler, we will have more from you on Monocle on Sunday, I'm sure, for this, but just a little bit of a sneak preview. What are you expecting from the World Economic Forum? What would you sort of like to see happen there? It's been a, frankly, for me, a bit of a strange event because it's sort of this strange timing that you have for it. What are you expecting to get decided?
Yeah, you're right. It has crept up on us. And of course, we've been through 2 years of canceled or postponed, reshuffled events. So here it comes. And it has just sort of appeared because I was, oh my goodness, it's like, right, you know, Davos is on. We've been so focused because we've got our own conference coming up. Small plug here, listeners. But second, third, and fourth, you know, it's 2 weeks from this evening that many of us will be in Paris. We will just be coming off stage, heading to La Coupole for a lovely evening. So we have our quality of life conference. So I've been very focused on that. But yes, Davos is here. It's going to be getting very busy at Zurich Airport from tomorrow, and it's a great time for plane spotters. Of course, we've done the story many times, but this, of course, is when you have some of the most extraordinary private aircraft and government aircraft descending on Closton Airport. What am I expecting, Chris? I would say probably three things. One, I think we're going to get to, I hope, an interesting series of conversations about where next for Russia. And I think where next for Russia, not in terms of Russia the aggressor, but we talk about the Russian economy, Russian society. I was having a discussion with a number of business leaders this week when I was in Paris, and many companies are caught right now. I was talking to one big luxury goods group. They're employing almost 10,000 people still. All of the stores are closed. Some of their supply network, et cetera, is open, but still they have 10,000 people on the payroll. They're paying them full salary. What do they do? Do they exit the country and 10,000 people are out of a job? Or do they say, actually, we're going to have to kickstart as well, because you're really caught in a very, very difficult position. It's not the fault of those 10,000 employees who are there. So I think that is going to be a conversation. I think we have a big conversation about China and a conversation as to what's going to happen with policy. I was in Japan last week. We see a lot of Asia being very slow to wake up to really where the rest of the world is right now. And now we have a China at the moment where, of course, you know, we have people who have been behind doors for 5-6 weeks, who've been shipped off 500 kilometers away to go to, a fever hospital. There's a lot of Western executives or executives from outside of China who, this is a very interesting conversation. Schools are going to be getting out soon. Are those people coming back? Are you going to want to go back to Shanghai, Shenzhen? So I think we have a big conversation there. And I think the third discussion that what I'm looking for is just people to have a considered and reasoned point of view about what does business look like again. And I say this because I was at a meeting yesterday. All of our colleagues, arrived, flew in for a meeting, and someone who was probably a kilometer away decided not to come to the meeting because they had a new puppy. And that is not, that can't be the new normal, that people are flying in, but you choose not to come because you have a dog. But anyway, that's a whole other discussion.
That is a whole other discussion. Carlotta?
I was going to say, I think it really highlights the importance of being face-to-face. I mean, one of the things, we're heading there as our Monocle 24 team from Sunday night. Three of us will be there reporting, and it's there's just no comparison to when you're in the room and are able to have these face-to-face conversations. And even if you're not part of the conversation, but seeing it, there's a lot of subtle communication, as we all know, in being face-to-face to each other. And other than that, going to a snowless Davos is going to be the only major difference. And we're forgetting, of course, I mean, we're forgetting, it's inevitable. But that, I think, was also a way of gently nudging us to another big topic, which is, of course, climate change, which COP26 didn't produce the results people expected. With everything that's going on with Russia's war in Ukraine, that has understandably, in a way, got to, you know, the backdrop. But it is a conversation that a lot of businesses are asking, that a lot of governments, we've seen record levels of ministers for climate action being appointed, not only in our patch of the world here in the European continent, but in the Americas too. Particularly South America has been quite good at this. Those are just some of the things that personally I'm quite looking forward to.
And just one thing that I think I want Carlotta, and well, we can all look forward to this tomorrow. We have a very special singer coming in. So where we're standing, so we're in the, of course, the broadcasting space here at Duforstrasse. This will be turned into a bit of a bossa nova, a little bit of a bossa nova moment for you, Carlotta, tomorrow. So we have Cecilia Stalin. Many of our listeners might know her because she's really the voice of our Christmas markets. But she's never doing anything bossa then. She's singing in Swedish. But she's flown in from Brazil and she will be on stage tomorrow. You might even hear from her throughout the day as well.
Oh, amazing. I can't wait to join in.
She will be serenading Switzerland, Zurich into Davos for the rest of the week, where we will continue to cover all of those very complicated issues that Tyler and Carlotta were talking about there for Davos. Monocle's editorial director, Tyler Brulé, thank you very much for joining us. Carlotta, stay with us because I will also want to bring in Monocle's Toronto bureau chief now, Thomas Lewis, because this has been quite a week for U.S. politics. It is just under 6 months until the next round of major elections in the United States, but we're starting to get a clear idea of just what kind of choice Americans are going to face. The midterm congressional elections in November, we'll see all members of the House of Representatives and one-third of the U.S. Senate elected. This week saw both parties hold a number of primaries to decide on their respective candidates. It's also the first nationwide election since the erratic 2020 presidential campaign. This really matters because it has to be said that some candidates, particularly on the Republican side, are still questioning the validity of that result. And Donald Trump himself is injecting himself into the race, suggesting voter fraud is to blame for a particularly close primary in Pennsylvania. All of that said, Thomas Lewis, welcome to the show. Tell us a little bit about what we learned this week and what kind of candidates both parties are picking.
Well, without wanting to slip too much, Chris, into this sort of slightly cliched sort of generalism, but I think what we've seen on both sides following this week's primaries, on both the Republican side and the Democratic side, is that it is, in fact, a bit of a split picture. So if we look at the Republican side so far, the big sort of anticipation on the part of the US media has been just how potent is an endorsement from former President Donald Trump for those Republican candidates seeking election in November. And, you know, if this week's events and this week's results, some of which we still don't know fully, given the process of counting mail-in ballots, you know, that seems to be a bit of a mixed picture in its own right. You mentioned Pennsylvania there. Of course, the big sort of glitzy showbiz candidate for the Republicans is the TV doctor, Dr. Mehmet Oz. He has, you know, enjoyed Donald Trump's support for some time, but it appears to be a neck and neck tie with his challenger, David McCormick. Now, they almost certainly seem to think, if the coverage in the US press is to be read correctly, then there will almost certainly be a recount there. But it could be several weeks, given that there's quite a high number, it seems, of mail-in ballots that are yet to be counted. And then, you know, the Pennsylvania race will also be interesting on the Democratic side. There's a very popular Democratic figure, John Fetterman. He won his primary. Now, his own personal story just in the past week has been a pretty extraordinary one. He suffered a stroke last week and still went on to win the Democratic primary. Now, President Joe Biden said said after that result that he would wholeheartedly campaign on John Fetterman's behalf ahead of the election. I think if we just do look briefly, Chris, at the Democratic side, you know, you and I have discussed over the years kind of in quite some detail about this sort of the divide between the more progressive side of the Democratic Party and the more centre-left side of the party. Well, I think both of those sides have actually done quite well so far. So, you know, some of the press in the US is describing this as this great sort of fissure, this great split between the wings of the party. But actually, it could be quite interesting, you know, if Democrats sort of galvanize and want to really put a sort of, you know, unified challenge to the Republican opponents in the midterms, then actually it might not be a bad thing to have a sort of mixed roster from all corners of the party, if you like. So that's my take, I'd say, Chris, over the past week's events in the United States.
Well, Carlotta, Thomas mentioned Pennsylvania there. I think it is a particularly interesting sort of microcosm of the country as a whole when you look at the races that are happening in Pennsylvania because of, as Thomas said there, you have somebody like Dr. Oz campaigning. On the Democratic side, you have a relative moderate, potentially, you know, as Thomas was describing there as well, former lieutenant governor. It's an interesting race. And then you have these sort of accusations of possible electoral fraud. I mean, it kind of has everything that the 2020 election had, doesn't it?
Yes, it's kind of an attempt to kind of almost rerun 2020 in a smaller scale. I think what's interesting here is how Donald Trump does really still overshadow everything. You know, the fact that even we had one of the GOP Senate candidates, Kathy Barnett, saying, you know, MAGA, Make America Great Again, that is, of course, does not belong to President Trump. That's one of the things she declared in a debate ahead of the election, which the fact that it's still peppered throughout every decision making, every influence, the fact that, as Thomas just mentioned, Dr. Oz got endorsed by Donald Trump. It just, to me, shows that a lot of people are paying attention, of course, to what's happening in Pennsylvania, because if it goes, the Republicans and the Trump Republican side of the party, this really, I think, will change how seriously people are taking the claims of him going ahead in 2024. If the fact that perhaps under the Republican impression, Joe Biden hasn't met the expectations for Democrats, it is quite a worrying scenario in the sense that it just feels like such recent history. And I think that's exactly what you described, Chris. It is a microcosm of what is happening in the broader nation.
Well, and Thomas, there's two ways to look at Donald Trump's influence, frankly, in this election. One is the sort of political side, as Carlotta was alluding to there. Will he or won't he run? The other is just the legacy of 2020 and all the questions that were raised about the legitimacy of Joe Biden's election there. I wonder for you, there's two ways here too as well to look at it. How much has that played in these elections? How many candidates are still questioning that result? And what has been done, I suppose, to allay fears, real or completely imagined as so many of them were, of electoral fraud ahead of November?
Well, I think it's a really interesting point, Chris. And I think what we might see, you know, history tells us that the party in the White House tends to sort of get potentially a bit of a drubbing in the midterms to keep that party in check. But I think if you look at the events that have sort of taken place that are continuing to take place in the United States around the economy, around inflation, even around issues such as the supply of baby formula across the country, which is a massive story at the moment. I just wonder whether, you know, the narrative so far for the Democrats has been almost this inevitability that the Republicans will take at least the House of Representatives come November. You are, I think it's worth noting, seeing some little hints of commentary here and there from some of the legacy papers that actually maybe the Democrats could add a few senators and keep their control there. And maybe it isn't totally out of the question that they could indeed sort of hold the, you know, House of Representatives as well. Obviously, this is all speculation at the moment. But I think, you know, I I think if you look at the successes the Democrats have had in midterm elections in the past, I think it's when they've made issues front and center rather than personalities. That's when they've had success. So the last time around, every Democratic candidate pretty much was advised, was instructed to use healthcare because that had become such a football hot potato issue for Republicans. To make healthcare and the fact that Democrats would stand up for Americans' rights to access healthcare the main issue. And that largely really worked very well for them. So I think if you look at the way that you're seeing a lot of Republicans still, you know, voting against Democratic policies, whatever they are, it seems, you know, even over this baby formula crisis, you saw a number of Republicans, the number of politicians who were voting against them, they were pretty much all Republicans. So I think if the Democrats, you know, do want a chance here, it might be wise to sort of take some of these very live issues and really sort of hold the Republican side to account on where they stood on it when an opportunity to solve some of these issues came along.
Just finally and quickly, Carlotta, although it is a very complicated issue, but speaking of hot button issues, abortion is, of course, going to be a key one also in November with this pending Supreme Court ruling striking down the right to an abortion across the United States, the constitutional right. How is that playing out, do you feel, in this election cycle?
Oh, I think particularly the midterms are going to be decisive for this this issue. This pending decision from the U.S. Supreme Court is really highlighting the importance of electing, state representatives that truly represent your views and not just assume that because they're from the party you traditionally have voted for, that those views will be protected. If the decision, as we're expecting, goes ahead, it will be down to state law to either keep these protections for women who want to access a legal and safe way of having an abortion or not. And anyone who thinks that making abortion illegal will stop the number of abortions has not looked at the data. All is going to happen is that this won't be able to happen in a safe way. And if the aim is to protect lives because all lives matter, a decision like that is putting the lives of grown women at risk.
Carlotta Ribello and Thomas Lewis, thank you for the moment. You are listening to The Monocle Daily. Now, ahead of the world's business and political leaders gathering for the World Economic Forum in Davos next week, Monocle's business editor David Hodari has been spending the past week here in Zurich gauging the mood of economists and investors to hear what they expect from world leaders next week. David joins me now here in the studio to discuss what he's learned. David, I joined you for one of these meetings with Swiss bankers. The mood is pretty gloomy, isn't it?
Gloomy is one way of putting it. I would say best markets in the economy are receiving mixed reviews right now. You joined me yesterday for a meeting with the CIO of Julius Baer, which is a private Swiss bank. I believe the exact phrase he used was that in markets right now, there's nowhere to hide.
So Ukraine was a focus for the CIO of Julius Baer. Was that something that many others that you spoke to agreed with? What kind of focuses did they have? There were also things like the pandemic, obviously, that were coming out of, that were happening just ahead of the World Economic Forum as well.
Sure. I mean, it's certainly the case that the delegates of the WEF have quite a lot on their plate going into the forum. And the pandemic, the supply chain issues, pretty steep inflation that we're seeing right now are all part of that. But Ukraine has certainly added an extra layer to that inflation. The sanctions that have been placed on Russia have driven up the prices of resources like oil and metals, and in some cases, a lot of food supply as well. So it may have been the case that the Julius Baer CIO was a little bit more gloomy than some of the other people we spoke with. But it's also the case that all of them mentioned Ukraine as being among their chief concerns.
What was the sense that you got from them of what they might want policymakers and business leaders to do about it? Davos itself is not necessarily something where decisions are made, but it is about getting a general consensus out of it from politicians and business makers coming together. What did you get the sense of what the priorities were that they would want to be, you know, things to be decided on?
I mean, like you said, Chris, the World Economic Forum is just that. It's a forum rather than a summit. It's not like a G20 or a COP26, whereby if no big concrete decisions are made at the end of it, it's seen as an overwhelming failure. It's really more of a place in which to form some kind of consensus. albeit one that not everybody agrees to. And different people I spoke with this week had different priorities. There is a sort of multiplicity of views on what central banks are doing around the world right now. Some people think that inflation, we're seeing the peak of it now. Some people think we're not going to see the peak of it for another 6 months to a year. There are also these pretty universal concerns that we are heading for a recession in the West as well. And if you look at financial markets over the past week, those fears are being borne out. Defensive stocks, which you could characterize as food companies, clothes manufacturers, which typically do well in economically fraught times, are also receiving a beating, which suggests that not only is inflation affecting things like energy, that's broadening out to other parts of the economy too.
Just finally, David, from that, I guess, the question is also, aside from coming to some sort of consensus about how serious this is, where inflation is going, do you get any sense from the people you speak to about what can be done about it? It's been interesting over the last week following, you know, certain central bankers, even the Bank of England, talking about being essentially helpless because this is from the war in Ukraine. And then some people like Julius Baer just talking about this being a massive shift in how we have to think, how the economy works because of the lack of supply. Is there something that you think policymakers will do, can decide to do together about it next week?
I think expecting world bankers to execute a coordinated policy plan is probably expecting too much of them. What we are seeing is central banks using the relatively limited tools at their disposal to try and get inflation under control. So raising interest rates, which means it costs more to borrow money and incentivizes people to save rather than to be spending that pent-up pandemic money and fueling this inflation further. That's one option. Reducing the amount of cheap money that they're pumping into the global financial system is another. And past that, to deal with inflation, there aren't that many options that they have. There are also pretty significant and growing worries that if they push too hard on the brakes, if they try and pump those brakes too hard on inflation, they could risk sending major global economies like the US, like the UK, like the Eurozone into recession.
David Hodari, Monocle's business editor, thank you very much for joining us. This is the Monocle Daily, and I'm Chris Chermak in Monocle's Zurich headquarters. By the way, any sounds that you might be hearing from these headquarters are the setup for the body market we were talking earlier, getting very excited over here already in Zurich ahead of that. Still with us, though, are Carlotta Ribello here in Zurich and Thomas Lewis in Toronto. And we turn to the UK for now. It is a huge year for the royal family with the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. And I think it is fair to say it's been something of a rocky start. Not only had there been some questions about the Queen's health, but visits by other royals to Commonwealth states haven't really been going quite as planned in the last few months. This week, it's been the turn of Canada to get the UK royal treatment with a flyby 3-day visit from Prince Charles and Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall. Thomas, tell us, what have they been up to and what's the reception been like?
Well, it was a very tightly choreographed visit, Chris. And as you said, you know, officially, this was a visit to mark the Queen's Platinum Jubilee. The Queen, of course, is the head of state here in Canada. But the focus in terms of the sort of the messaging, if you like, ahead of the arrival was very much that Prince Charles and Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, would make meeting Indigenous people and Indigenous groups the heart of their visit. And that's what they did. We are, of course, kind of at a time still really following the huge nationwide protests last year following the discovery at several former residential schools of unmarked graves, many of them of apparently of children who were forced into this system during the colonial era here in Canada. That was a system that was, of course, funded by the government here, but run by the Catholic Church. And I think very significantly, we've seen a sort of increasing tempo of public statements, of public apologies even. And in July, the Pope himself will travel to Canada, and there is expected to be an official apology on the part of the Catholic Church for its role in this system then. So I think this visit, in a way, became a part of that narrative, if you like, rather than necessarily having Queen Elizabeth's 70-year reign be the focus. As I said, it was very tightly choreographed, so there weren't many opportunities for anything to go particularly wrong, I think it's fair to say, as we saw earlier this year when William and Kate, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, visited the Caribbean, which, you know, from a PR standpoint, really didn't go according to plan in lots of ways. So I think there was a real addressing of that in this very tightly choreographed visit by Charles and Camilla this week, Chris.
Well, Carlotta, Thomas brings up a number of points there. It is interesting that this trip was more about listening and learning and perhaps being in tune with the mood in Canada. But tell us a little more broadly, as we are entering this Platinum Jubilee year, why have we had all of these PR challenges at the moment? What is it about the UK royal family right now that seems to rub some people at least the wrong way?
Well, I don't know if it's just a reflection of the times we live in, really, Chris. So, of course, the monarchy is an institution that's centuries old, and it doesn't necessarily move at the same pace as the rest of society has been moving in terms of recognizing our own failures. You know, even within our own lifetime, I can recognize things that probably when I was younger would be considered okay that no longer are the case, or ways of thinking about the world that clearly are not correct. And I don't feel like the royal family, in the eyes of many of these critics, has done enough to follow the times, because perhaps if it does so, it becomes an existential question. Now, we know that the trip by Will and Kate to the Caribbean was described by many as, you know, the perfect storm. From Thomas alluded there, from photo ops that, you know, of shaking hands with children in Jamaica through wired fences, to really a series of faux pas after one another. It wasn't a good tour that was initially meant to strengthen the Commonwealth, after many countries indicated that they were considering withdrawing from that union. And it didn't exactly pan out that way. Now, I take to issue some of this stuff that's happening now, because as you described, this is meant to be a listen and learn tour. Why did it take all this long to start listening and learning? That's what I would be asking. So it makes me think that maybe the PR advising them wasn't that that sharp, because if I was a PR, I was like, do not utter those words, because the first question anyone's going to ask is, did it take you until now to start listening and learning? Shouldn't you have been doing that all along?
Only starting the listening tour, yes, at a late stage. I mean, Thomas, to get back to you then on that, aside from the tours, I suppose the question as well is, are there any existential questions, as Carlotta put it there, in Canada? What is the feeling more generally right now? Is the royal family, is the monarchy stable, popular?
Well, it's again a really interesting question, because there was some criticism in the press by certain figures that actually in some of Canada's big cities, the celebrations for the Queen's Platinum Jubilee were just not big enough, that Canada didn't appear to be taking this seriously enough. I think if you look at the sort of public opinion polls about how Canadians feel about their connection to the British royal family, I mean, it's been pretty evenly split. The anger Reid Institute, which is a big sort of polling firm here in Canada, they released a poll about sentiment in Canada towards the UK royal family to mark the Queen's recent birthday. And previously, I think, if I've remembered the numbers correctly, those numbers were about 47% on either side, so in support of and against being tied to the UK royal family. This recent opinion poll, however, showed that actually those opposed were actually sort of, the numbers were creeping up a little bit to around 51%, if I recall. It is worth noting that the popularity of the Queen herself is still pretty enormous here, that there is a very sort of deep public affection. I think it was around 60% was found in this recent opinion poll of a very warm feeling to the Queen herself on, I suppose, a more sort of personal level. You know, I guess over the past few years, we've seen countries like Australia sort of be quite public about the fact that, you know, once a new monarch takes the throne, grown in the UK, perhaps that's the time when a country like Australia will look at sort of withdrawing its current sort of constitutional relationship with the UK. That kind of conversation isn't really happening here in Canada. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who isn't asked that regularly about this, I don't think, but he is asked about it and has been quite sort of quick to sort of distance himself from any kind of big existential statements on what the future of Canada, potentially away from the UK royal family might mean. So I guess that's a bit of a snapshot, Chris, of the sentiment here in this Jubilee year here in Canada.
Well, Carlotta, just finally on this, the Jubilee year has so many different aspects to it. There will be so many celebrations and different ways to mark this, including a two-day public holiday, bank holiday here. But one curious aspect is that 8 towns will be made a city, including one metropolis in the Falklands with a grand total of 2,500 citizens. What goes into these kinds of considerations?
I know, that surprised me as well. I mean, as you mentioned there, the Jubilee celebrations seem to be including a bit of everything. There's, you know, the new recipes for Queen Elizabeth's own sponge cake, and now we have 8 new cities in the UK. Yes, Stanley in the Falklands is the first in this list that is an overseas territory. And also a crown dependency, Douglas in the Isle of Man, that is winning a city status. Now, of course, with the city status, it comes a boost in funding. It also comes a boost in support by the Cabinet Office. And, you know, research says that the local economy tends to expand between 10 to 13% to the smaller towns when they do get city status. Now, of course, we are in an odd year when it comes to boosting economy, so I'm not sure if the research would apply to that. But yes, this is a town that has 2,458 inhabitants. This is according to the latest census, and it's just going to have a bunch of specific holidays to mark the occasion. I think at least 4 or 5 events happening around the Jubilee bank holiday weekend. I just start thinking about any other place in the UK that might have, you know, just one extra person at least. Like I think it's the size of the population that is tickling everyone and that has made this story jump out of all of them. I mean, it must be said that the members of the royal family have regularly visited these islands since, you know, basically in 1957, more or less. And even the Duke of Cambridge, I believe 2016, 2017, spent over a month, nearly 2 months over there for a research project. So it's not that disconnected from the royal family. But of course, it might be the biggest small city we'll ever know.
Absolutely. Not disconnected, the Falklands are crucial to the UK going forward. More from Carlotta and Thomas, our short check-in, I should say, at the end. But it is time now for our letter from New York City. This week, Henry Rees Sheridan takes a closer look at the Big Apple's strategy now that COVID cases are increasing once again.
This week, New York turned orange. What I mean is it entered into the high-risk segment of the official colour-coded alert system linked to the risk posed by COVID-19 in the city.
The 7-day positivity rate in New York City is 9.11%, with the total number of cases increasing, and in some neighbourhoods, the positivity rate is 20%. That all helped to move the city's alert level to high.
NYC is logging 4,000 new cases daily. The real figure is probably much higher because most home tests aren't logged in the official tally. This means the city is either on the threshold of its fifth COVID wave or is already well into it, depending on how you measure. During the fourth wave, back in December, the city reintroduced mask mandates that it had scrapped. And according to the colour-coded alert system, the government should be reintroducing mask mandates again right now. But Mayor Eric Adams is choosing to ignore his own administration's guidelines. At a news conference, he said that if New York responded to every new variant and spike with a movement towards new restrictions, it would cease to function as a city.
Variants are going to continue to come. It appears as though there's a new norm that is settling in our city, in our countries. Variants are going to come. If every variant that comes, we move into shutdown thoughts, we move in through panicking, we're not going to function as a city.
Since he took office, Adams has consistently focused on the city's economic recovery and encouraged a return to normalcy wherever possible. In March, he relished scrapping the city's mask mandates, especially those enforced in public schools, which were objected to by many parents.
And I'm glad to say that the rates are low enough that the mandatory program is no longer needed. No longer needed. Beginning Monday, March 7th, we will be suspending the requirements under Key 2 NYC.
Some think Adams' bullish attitude is dangerous and that going against the official guidelines undermines his office's credibility. But Adams won the mayoral Democratic primary over more progressive candidates because he has a good sense of what New Yorkers actually want. And I suspect his decision to avoid new mask mandates, despite the relatively high rates of coronavirus, reflects the popular will. No one wants to go back to wearing masks and having their vaccine status checked. This was evident at Freeze New York, the massive art fair that kicked off this week in the Hudson Yards complex on the west side of Manhattan. I was there on the opening day to cover it. There was a massive queue of people outside the venue before the doors opened. Event workers walked up and down the line, checking people's vaccination status and handing out masks while reminding people they had to wear one. The workers' friendly officiousness was met with a collective weary impatience and, on the part of at least one attendee I was standing behind, outright hostility. The art people wanted to get back to mingling and spending loads and loads of money on art, and all this paperwork was cramping their style. The fact is, people who shop for art at a place like Freeze aren't used to being told what to do. Their buried resentment can manifest itself in antisocial behaviour. I saw one attendee brazenly vaping within metres of a security steward. The vapor seemed genuinely surprised to be asked to stop sucking on his jewel in front of everyone. Yet the attendees at Freeze are exactly the kind of people that Eric Adams wants in the city. During the pandemic, the wealthy left New York in droves. They have started coming back, and Adams is keen to keep them here. He fears losing the city's most lucrative tax base. It's this logic that in no small part drives Adams' reluctance to reimpose mask mandates to curb the spread of the virus. Aside from making the city a less convenient place to live, such restrictions would make it harder for companies to justify reopening offices in NYC, something Adams sorely wants to happen. But if virus numbers continue to increase in the face of Adams's obstinacy, things could get medically and politically ugly.
That was Henry Reese Sheridan. Thanks to him for that. And finally, today, if you are looking for a cheap summer vacation, you might want to take a closer look at Germany. The country's parliament, or the upper parliament, the Bundesrat, has approved a scheme that offers everyone a monthly rail ticket for the low, low price of 9 euros. Yes, 9 euros for an entire month of travel across the country in either June, July, or August. The catch? Well, it doesn't include the fancy high-speed trains that will get you from one side to the other, only the slower regional ones and city public transport options like metros, buses, and trams. Carlotta, you are the producer of our Urbanist podcast. You have to love this one, don't you?
Absolutely. Not only do I love trains, obviously there's the whole sustainability side of it, but I also love a bargain. And the fact that
all
it's
all about the bargain.
It's all about that. You know, when the low costs first appeared, I would sacrifice my own comfort and well-being and how many clothes I could wear in my own body for a cheap ticket to get anywhere out of Portugal. But yes, this seems like a great initiative. We're talking here. Also, it's important to say that these tickets are for the regional trains, which often are the ones that get overlooked for when people want to travel in a country. They will, of course, book the high-speed ones or the faster ones, the ones that connect directly from A to B. And this might be a chance for some of the smaller towns along the way, not even cities along the way, to get some tourism too and to get a tiny bit of a boost in a local economy. Who knows if just if it doesn't matter in terms of the price and how many stops you can go, maybe you're just going by a town that you find interesting and you end up getting off at that station rather than going straight to your destination in their own country and discover a bit more about it too.
Absolutely. And I can personally attest, as someone who lived in Germany for about 6 years, that there are some wonderful smaller towns around the big cities. I lived in Frankfurt for a couple of years and toured the region around Hesse, which is beautiful and would be a great place to do with regional trains. Berlin as well, and Brandenburg. So it really does offer you that option. But Thomas, I mean, it probably defeats the purpose, particularly since the goal of this is to spotlight public transport and low emissions options if you fly all the way from Toronto for this in Germany. But would you take up the option of a slow train trip through Canada, perhaps, if offered?
Oh, I absolutely would. And the sort of national rail, passenger rail carrier is called Via Rail here, and I am a big fan. I've had such lovely train journeys, you know, either from Toronto to Montreal, and, you know, the distances here are pretty vast. So quite often the train is the sort of best way to do it if you've got the time to travel. And I just think it is that sort of sense of not really being in a rush, you know, and just being sort of nice and settled in a train carriage for however long it is. I did a big rail trip around the US a few years ago. I was in a bit of a shoestring back then, but it was this big loop from Washington up to San Francisco and then back to New York. And honestly, I didn't have the money to spend on these lovely sort of sleeper carriages. So I was just in my chair every night for a month, pretty much, with some stops along the way. But it just still stays with me as one of the most magical trips, because you make these friends, even if those friendships only last for the duration of the journey, that are really tied to the journey itself, and it's really magic. I would say that actually, just to bring things back to Toronto here, we are in an election period here in the province. The provincial election takes place on the 2nd of June, and one of the most eye-catching proposals, I suppose, from the Liberal Party here is to make all public transport journeys $1 a buck a ride, it's being pitched as. And that's really sort of caught people's attention, because of course with this, you know, a fondness of home working, people are now coming back to the offices, but you know, the cost of living pressures that lots of places are feeling at the moment are definitely being felt here too. And ridership of the Toronto transit system, for example, definitely took a big hit during the months of lockdown here. So it's quite eye-catching. So the idea of sort of, you know, making a big standout price for a journey on public transport, Chris, is one that's certainly trying to get some attention here as well.
Now, there are two positive offers for you, Toronto and Germany, a buck or €9. That is all the time we have for this edition of The Monocle Daily. A big thanks to my panelists today, Carlotta Ribello here in Zurich and Thomas Lewis in Toronto. And also, of course, to Monocle's Tyler Brulé at the top and Henry Reese Sheridan and David Hodari. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello here in Zurich and researched by Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu in London. I'm Chris Termack here in Zurich. The Monocle Daily is back at the same time on Monday. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.